Last week we looked at here in our study in Genesis the incident, a little incident of the flood, universal flood. Remember the setting there was that the situation on the earth had gotten so bad, so corrupted, so depraved, that 1656 years after Adam, the statement concerning mankind was that his thoughts were only evil continuously. That's a pretty sweeping statement, isn't it? And God said, man, I'm sorry I made him. We're going to do this over again. And so he wiped out mankind, probably numbering, I would think, at least around a billion or a few billion, with a universal flood. Where'd the water come from? It said it rained 40 days and 40 nights. Is that like what you know about? No, the rain wasn't what you know about. The hydrological cycle that you know about today that produces rain wasn't in effect yet. That water came from two places. The earth, from within the earth itself, it came roaring up and it came crashing down from that canopy that was above the earth. And so for 40 days and 40 nights, the planet was just pulverized by water and eventually wiped out everybody on it, except for Noah and his family, a total of 8 people out of maybe a billion or two were spared from the flood. They were on the ark for about how long? 1 year. 1 year and 3 weeks, roughly. So the whole cycle took about a year. The water rose for about 150 days, and then it started settling back out and took a little more while for things to get back where they could disembark, but eventually they did after about a year and a few weeks. And so they came out of the ark, verse 18 of chapter 9, Noah and his sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And they all departed from the ark and started then to live anew here on the earth. Verse 19 of chapter 9, these three were the sons of Noah, and from them the whole earth was populated. So your ancestor is one of those three sons of Noah, Shem, Ham, or Japheth. Your ancestor was for sure Noah, but we split up after that, and most of us in this room today probably came from Japheth. Any Jews in here? All right, you would have come from Shem, and the others came from Ham. We'll talk about him here this morning, but those three are our ancestors. So they're off of the ark. They're restarting to populate the earth and to live anew following the flood and its devastation. So let's pick up at verse 20 of Genesis chapter 9. Then Noah began farming and he planted a vineyard. Now, why would he be concerned with a vineyard rather early on after the flood? Wouldn't you think he might be planting some corn or some oats or some soybeans or something like that? Why didn't he just drink the water and plant something else? Ever hear of Montezuma's revenge? That's why he didn't drink the water. No, they needed to get some grapes going because the only safe drink around was one they made themselves out of a wine. And so it would make sense that they would do this early on, get some wine going. And so he planted his vineyard. And verse 21, he drank of the wine and he became drunk. And he uncovered himself inside his tent. Now there's two things that either one of which need to be properly managed, but you rarely would want to mix them, would you? Being drunk and naked. One or the other can get you in just about as much trouble as you need to be in. He mixed them together. Now, the interpretation of this passage that you encounter from various commentators and so on seems to vary between one extreme and the other. One extreme is guys want to dump pretty hard on Noah here. And they say, look, this guy is just really a total loser here. Not only did he get drunk, but he uncovered himself. So he has really exhibited very poor self-control. He let his guard down very badly, and is just really a total loser. Is that in keeping with the character we've seen in this man for the previous 600 years? No, that would be way out of character for him, wouldn't it? This is the only righteous man on the earth when the flood came. So if that indeed is the proper understanding, is that he really slipped up, he really messed up this time, then that would really be quite an abrupt change in his character. Is that possible? Yeah, we can all do that, can't we? We know that we can all slip up no matter how disciplined a life we live. We can always mess it up. And the world is just delighted when we do. The lost world takes great pleasure in watching the righteous fall. And it takes one slip up in a 600-year life. We won't have to probably go quite that long. One slip up in our lives and it can ruin your whole testimony. People will discredit you and never believe another thing you say because they just delight in seeing the righteous fall. So it is possible that that's what happened to him here, that he just simply dropped his guard, acted irresponsibly for a change, and both got drunk and uncovered himself. Now, the other extreme that you usually find is a little easier on Noah, and I kind of like the easier deal. Now, remember that he's planting grapes and making wine in a new environment to him. The barometric pressures and the environment that he's now in were different than the one before the flood, substantially so. So the barometric pressures are different. Do grapes ferment differently with different environmental conditions? I've read that it's much easier to get drunk at altitude than it is at sea level. Can anybody verify that for me? I'll take your word, whatever you say. It may be that this kind of snuck up on him, that he doesn't quite yet understand how much wine he can drink. Maybe it's a little stronger than what he's used to in the new environment. I don't know. I'm just grasping at something here that makes a little sense that's in keeping with his good character. If that's the case, maybe he just drank a little too much and didn't know quite what he was getting into, and it got the best of him and he just got drunk. Rather than being irresponsible and dropping his guard, he just kind of, the science got him. He didn't know maybe exactly what happened. And as far as this uncovering himself, maybe it's hot. He's in his own private residence, for goodness sake. He's a married man, and his wife is still alive. That doesn't seem to me to be quite as irresponsible as some other things that maybe could go on here. So maybe it's a little more innocent than we think. After all, if you can't uncover yourself in your own private residence, where can you? Whatever the case, these are the circumstances. He's both drunk and he's naked. He's uncovered in his tent. That is either quite irresponsible, and it's hard for me to see why it is so irresponsible, or it's just kind of an unfortunate set of circumstances. Well, here's what happens then. Ham, remember his three sons, Shem, Japheth, and Ham. Ham, the father of Canaan, and we'll see why that keeps being mentioned here in just a little bit. He saw the nakedness of his father. How did that happen? How did this guy get in Noah's private residence, his tent, and see his father in this undignified particular state of affairs being uncovered? And notice the drunkenness has kind of dropped here. That doesn't seem to be a part of the problem at all going forward here. It's his nakedness that becomes the problem that his son Ham sees. How does he get in there? Doesn't he announce himself? Doesn't he knock on the door of the tent and ask, you know, can I come in? The guy seems to be a little bit presumptuous to just go into his father, and his mother could have been in there, for goodness sake. He could have walked in on the two of them. So what in the world is he doing that he goes in there? He obviously isn't exhibiting a great deal of respect for his own father's residence and mother's. But he goes in there and he sees his dad in this undignified manner. And the word that is translated Saul here, from everything I can tell from various commentators and so on, means that he saw with delight his father. Now, as I mentioned to you before, the world is usually quite happy to see the righteous fall. And it appears here that the son is somewhat resentful of his father's righteous behavior and high standing before God. And he takes some kind of somewhat twisted pleasure in seeing his father in this particular condition. He saw him, and he saw him with some delight. So how does he respond to this situation? He runs out and tells his brothers. Now, why does he have to do that? Why doesn't he just, one, either cover his father, or two, just get himself out of the place? He wouldn't have any business being in the first place. Or he could go find his mother and tell her, go check out Dad, he needs your help. Here's, things ain't just perfect here. But no, he runs and rats out his father to his brothers. He's taken such delight in seeing his father in this compromising situation that he can't wait to run out and tell the other two boys. Clearly his behavior is disrespectful. It's contemptuous of his father. This guy's got some problems between the headsets. Something ain't right in this guy's mind that he takes delight in what he has stumbled onto here. So he runs out and hopefully shares this juicy tidbit of impropriety that he's come upon here with his two brothers. But Shem and Japheth, they don't share the same kind of somewhat distorted and somewhat perverted attitude that Ham has. They took a garment and laid it upon their shoulders and walked backward and covered the nakedness of their father, and their faces were turned away so that they did not see their father's nakedness. They don't share the same kind of twisted viewpoint that their brother shared. They go in there and cover him in a way where they don't observe him, put a blanket between him and back over him, apparently something like that, and cover him. I don't quite understand everything in this incident because I don't know why it was so important that they cover him. Why not just leave him alone? He's in his own place. Let him wake up and he'll take care of himself. Or go get mom and let her go help him. Why do they have to do anything? Yeah, Bill?
Maybe he had a little Alzheimer's going on.
Well, at 600, Noah might have had it, but the boys have got no excuse here, don't they? Yeah. Any rate, there's just some oddities about the whole scene that is a little bit different here. But at least what they do is they try to be respectful of their dad and cover him. Now, maybe they're worried about, maybe there's grandchildren running around and somebody else could go in there, and maybe they felt a need to get him covered back up quickly. I don't know exactly what's transpired here. But at least they were noble enough to honor his dignity and cover him properly as compared to what Ham did. So they take care of the situation themselves. Perhaps that was the best way they could. Maybe mom was down at the mall shopping and they couldn't find her and get her in there to help him, and so they had to do it themselves. I don't know. So they do. They respond with some respect and admiration for their father, where Ham obviously was contemptuous and disrespectful. So when he wakes up from his wine, this is Noah, when Noah woke up from his wine, he knew what his youngest son had done to him. Now he's been covered. He wakes up covered with a blanket or something that wasn't his, and he said, uh-oh, somebody's been in here. Wifey, did you cover me up with this? Nope, I've never seen that thing before. So he figures out sooner or later, I guess, by questioning the folks that Ham had gone in there and saw him naked and went and got the other boys, and they came in and actually covered him. So he figures this out somehow. Now the word done to him, or the phrase done to him in verse 24, has been interpreted also with some very fanciful type interpretations. Be careful interpreting something that is not said. Stay with what's stated. Anything else is speculation. So you can carry this off into something pretty degenerate pretty quick. So let's be careful there. All we know is that he's been disrespected. He recognizes and realizes and understands that he's been disrespected. He must have figured out that Ham went and got the other boys and wanted to tell them, and that they are the ones that actually covered him. So he knows enough about the situation to apparently discern that the nature of one of his sons, Ham, is different from the other two, and it isn't particularly complimentary. So he pronounces this curse on these, well, it's a curse on Ham's descendants, it's a blessing on the others. But notice in verse 25 that the curse extends not to Ham, but to Canaan. Let me show you his line of descent real quick. Ham had these four sons, and the one over here, the youngest one, was Canaan. Noah's curse that he pronounces is on Ham's youngest son, Canaan. Not upon the other three, and not upon Ham himself. You see that genealogy there? The curse jumps over Ham, Noah's youngest son, and lands on Ham's youngest son, Canaan. And it's as though he's saying, in effect, since my youngest son disrespected and ridiculed me, his youngest son is going to disrespect and ridicule him. Now again, the interpretation of this curse has been highly debated for years. And again, it kind of goes from one extreme to the other, all over the place. Some people say, well, no, it applies to Ham and all of Ham's descendants, all four of his sons. All of the Hamites fall under this curse. But notice it didn't say anything about the other three sons. It just said, cursed be Canaan. So, again, if we stick to what we're actually told and don't get too crazy, I think we need to interpret the curse as applying to Canaan and his descendants. Well, if Moses is writing all of this at about the time of the Exodus, maybe the 40-year wandering afterwards, where is Moses and the people that he's writing this to, his reading audience, where are they headed? Where are they trying to get to? You've got this page 36 in your handout. We'll get back to it in just a little bit. I want to point something out to you as we go along. Where are they trying to get to? The promised land. Where's the promised land? Right there. Who's living there now? The Canaanites, the descendants of Canaan. The audience that's reading Moses' account here is being told by him that the people that they are going to encounter when they get to the promised land are these guys that are under the curse that Noah placed on them right there. They're Canaanites, they're descendants of Canaan. So it may be that the curse is put on him and his descendants because they are the people that God is going to wipe out and give that land to the Israelites, the Canaanites. And there's a bunch of different tribes in there. We'll talk about them more as we go along. So that may be why that it is mentioned here, because cursed be Canaan, because that's the people that they're going to encounter, and they're the ones that are going to fall under God's judgment when they get there. Okay, we'll talk about more of this in just a little bit. All right. So the first part of the Noah's statement, and by the way, these are the only words of Noah that are recorded in Scripture. Guy lives 950 years, and he speaks three or four words right here, and that's the ones that are recorded and nothing else. Cursed be Canaan, a servant of servants shall he be to his brothers. Canaan, descendants are going to be servants to, in some capacity, his other two brothers, the other two guys' lines of descent. And we'll talk more about that as we go along too. And he also said, blessed be the Lord God of Shem. Now notice that he doesn't, Noah doesn't bless Shem. He blesses Shem's God. There's Shem's descendants. But Noah's comment is, blessed be the Lord God of Shem, and let Canaan be his servant. That is, the Canaanites are going to serve the Shemites. Who are the Shemites? Well, that H gets dropped in time, and they become the Semites. Anti-Semitic, anti-Semites. They're the Jewish people, among others. So they become people that Ham's descendants will serve. So the relationship between Ham's descendants through Cain, and apparently only through Canaan, is that Canaan's descendants will serve in some way Ham's, Shem's descendants. Okay? And the third part of Noah's statement, verse 27, may God enlarge Japheth, that's the third son there, and let him dwell in the tents of Shem. Now, dwelling in someone else's tents is sharing their blessings in life. So the Japhethites, the descendants of that son, will enjoy and share the spiritual blessings of the Shemites that Noah has just pronounced there previously. They will get along well. They will dwell together. They will share the blessings of one another. So the Japhethites and the Shemites will be harmoniously sharing God's blessing, whereas the Canaanites will be serving them both. Let Canaan be his servant also, it is said. So the things that we can say for sure about this curse is that Canaan's descendants, it appears, will in some way be servants to both Shem's descendants and Japheth's descendants. And we'll put some of these on the map here in just a little bit. So Noah lived 350 years after the flood. That makes him 950. 950 years Noah lived. And the days of Noah were 950 years and he died. So this little incident at this particular point in Noah's life kind of sets a preview of the relationship between Noah's sons and some of these lines of descent that take place following the flood. All right. So about the only incident we have here immediately following the flood that we have any information on, and it involves what is very unpleasant behavior on the part of one of Noah's three sons. And the curse is actually pronounced on the grandson of Noah, Canaan. Okay? Now, it is interesting to note this. The Canaanites were bad idolaters. And as part of their idolatry, they practice a great deal of prostitution, both female and male prostitution. Jezebel, which would be, she would be about 500 years after this, she brought Baal worship into Israel from Phoenicia. She was a Phoenician princess. And she brought Baal worship into the nation Israel. And she had 450 male prostitutes in her household. Jezebel. Now, it seems somewhat related, perhaps, that the incident here involving Ham and Noah perhaps has a somewhat of a, maybe a homosexual tone to it. Some sort of a disrespecting of him in a way that was delightful for Ham. And his descendants then would be great promoters of then idolatrous worship involving male prostitutes, homosexuality. You see that tie-in? There's a relationship there. Several of the kings, both in the north and the south, and under the divided kingdom, tried to wipe out the residue of that. They weren't very successful. Remember Elijah's battle with Baal, the kings of Baal, and so on, and that deal there at Mount Carmel, and all that sort of stuff. That reflects what I'm suggesting to you might be a fulfillment of the heritage of Canaan here, because that's the way they were in their behavior. So there's a little bit of a relationship between this incident and what transpired later in Israel's history. All right, when we get to chapter 10 of the book of Genesis, we encounter what's oftentimes referred to by various commentators as the Table of Nations. And what we're going to see here in chapter 10 is a development of 70 different nations or lines of descent that define then these 70 nations that appear to be kind of what God called or what God viewed as sort of a fundamental national population of the planet into these 70 different nations or lines of descent. And they come from the three sons, of course. Who else are they going to come from? And Moses begins the development of them with Japheth here in verse 1 of chapter 10. And now, they go a little further than what I'm just showing on these charts, but here's the summary of his children and where these people are thought to have migrated to and sort of originated. Take everything you see that has to do with the founding of nations with a little bit of a grain of salt, because there's not 100% unanimity with all of that. People differ as to where these people came from and who their ancestries are, but this is what most people think. And so there's 14 of them listed here in chapter 10, verses 1 through 5, the sons of Japheth. And there you can see them, they're listed, and the countries that we think they actually sort of originally founded. So there's your first potful, and there's a total of 14 mentioned in Japheth's line of descent. I'll kind of show you a map here in a minute of, in general, where these people are. All right, and then in verse 6, the same thing transpires in regards to Ham, his sons. We've already seen a little bit of that. We'll see it again. This is page 33 in your handout. And there's Ham's four sons and the peoples that we believe they populated. And everybody listed there is a total of 30 nations listed under Ham. So 14 from Japheth and 30 from Ham. Verse 8 of chapter 10 mentions a guy that's worth noting there, Nimrod. Nimrod became a mighty one on the earth. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Therefore, it is said, like Nimrod, a mighty hunter before the Lord. He was so good of a hunter that he became a figure of speech. He's Michael Jordan of the hunters. Everybody recognized and knew him. You just mentioned his name and people knew who you were talking about because he had such a reputation and so on. This is a descendant of Ham. We'll see him again in a little bit. And some more came on down there. In verse 15, Canaan became the father of Sidon, his firstborn, and Heth, and the Jebusite, the Amorite, the Girgashite, the Hivite, the Arkite, and the Sinite. The Jebusite in verse 16 is kind of interesting. You remember when David established a city to be his capital under the United Kingdom, he picked Jerusalem. Why did he do that? Well, geographically, it's located right on the border between the northern 10 tribes and the southern 2 tribes, and he wanted them to be united together. So he picked a city that was kind of representing both geographic regions. Who lived in that city at the time? The Jebusites, one of the descendants of Canaan. They mouthed off to David, saying in essence, David, you couldn't take this city no matter what. So he takes it away from them. David's a guy you didn't mess with. Militarily, he was as good as there's ever been. So David takes their city away from them, Jerusalem, and makes that the capital of his kingdom. There were the Jebusites that were living there, mentioned there in verse 16 before he took it away from them. But he became the father of Sidon, and lists all these other ites that are around there. And the territory of the Canaanite extended from Sidon. Let me show you what he's talking about here. The territory of the Canaanite extended, verse 19 of Genesis 10, extended from Sidon as you go toward Gerar, as far as Gaza, as you go toward Sodom and Gomorrah and Admah and Zebulun, as far as Lasha. In other words, what he's just described there was this. Sidon is up here. This is Phoenicia up here. What he's saying is the Canaanites' territory extended from up here all the way down here to down here. What is that territory? That's Palestine, isn't it? That's the promised land. That's the land that God promised to the Israelites. I'll show you the promise here as we go along. So what he's saying here in tracing this line of descent down from Ham is that the people living in Israel or Palestine, when Joshua led the nation into there to take it back over, they were all Canaanites. From the north up around Phoenicia, all the way down to the south and over to the Jordan River. All of Palestine was occupied by these various ites here that are all descendants from Canaan. Got the picture? Israel's main primary enemy were Canaanites, the descendants of Cain. And there were various other tribes there, but they're all descendants of Cain. So Moses is tracing, I think, for his readership here, how it is those people got there. All of this were Canaanites that Joshua began to take back away from them when they entered in the promised land. And then in verse 21 following are the sons of Shem. We've seen a little bit of that already too. Before we get into that, let me show you one other photo here that you might find interesting. This is an aerial photograph of the Dead Sea region, and all of this territory you see in this picture here would have been occupied by the Canaanites. And as you look up there at the Dead Sea, the northern part of it that you can see there, that dark part, that's been there all along. That's a very deep lake, like 1600 feet, very deep. The light blue that you see down there to the south of it, that's very shallow. It's relatively new. The cities that God destroyed, Sodom and Gomorrah and all those other cities, are located right around here, right in this area right here. Archaeologists cannot find Sodom and Gomorrah. They have not been able to find those cities. Zoar and a few others around there, there might be a trace of it, but not Sodom and Gomorrah. The southern part of that Dead Sea there didn't used to be there. When God destroys Sodom and Gomorrah, he buries them and then he puts them underwater. The southern part of that lake was formed well after the northern part, much deeper, much different geography. So these Canaanites that are living in all of that territory you see here on this side, the left side of that Jordan River Valley, all up through there, and some of their most infamous cities like Sodom and Gomorrah were buried by God as part of the judgment and destruction on them. And you can't find those cities today because I think they're underneath that shallow end of the Dead Sea. That's why archaeologists can't find them. So he buried them under dirt and then he buried them underwater. So, interesting. We'll look at that again probably later when we get into that. But that's a interesting shot of how things are. Okay, back to Shem now and his line of descent. mentioned here in verse 21 and following. And I reason, well, he's going to pick this back up here again in just a minute, but of Shem now there are 26 nations actually formed. So we had 14 from Japheth, 30 from Ham, and we have the final 26 now from Shem. That gets us to the total of 70 nations that are formed from this line of descent. So you can read down through there and see all those names. Verse 25 of Genesis 10 is interesting. And two sons were born to Eber. Well, yeah, Eber. Verse 24 and 25 both mention this guy named Eber, E-B-E-R. That's where the name Hebrew comes from. Hebrew is a form of the word Eber. So when it is said later that Abraham was a Hebrew, he was a descendant of Eber. So that's where that name comes from, if you wonder. And another interesting character right there in that same verse, verse 25, is a guy named Peleg. Always want to call him Pegleg when I see his name. He's referenced because it was in his days that the earth was divided. What's that? The earth was divided in the days of Peleg. Well, it probably is a reference to the Tower of Babel and the dividing of the languages, which we'll see in a little bit. Some guys actually think it might be a reference to the continental divisions, continental drift, the dividing of the land masses into the continents that we have today. Probably that took place at the flood. That would make a lot more sense to me, that the upheavals and the wrecking of the earth's crust and surface would have been a lot more appropriate to have happened at the flood than later on, like we're seeing here under this guy. So probably it's a reference to the Tower of Babel and the dividing of the earth through the languages. But that gives you a chronological marker there for that, because in is the days of Peleg that that took place. So then he finishes up the rest of that stuff. So chapter 10 of Genesis, table of nations. It's where these different nations came from. 70 of them formed by the line of descent from the three sons of Noah, as given to you there in chapter 10. Apparently the 70 is what God considered sort of the baseline establishment of the nations of the earth. People migrate and mix and match, and we got about 195 nations today by statement, but there were 70 stated right here in Genesis chapter 10. All right, any questions about any of that before we go along? This is where the nations all came from. From those, of course, the sons of Noah, and then those are the specifics that he gives us here. Okay, let's babble a little bit then. Verse 1 of chapter 11, the whole earth used the same language and the same words. Well, why wouldn't they? Because they've all come from the same people, and there would be no reason for there to be more than one kind of language. I mean, Adam taught his children what he spoke, whatever it was. His children taught them what they spoke, which was what Adam spoke, and so on it goes. It's got one language. So it came about as they journeyed east that they found a plain in the land of Shinar, and they settled there. And let me kind of show you where this is, just in general. Back to this map here. They would have landed about right in through here in the Mount Ararat range up here in Turkey. And they're coming down to here. Shinar, this plain of Shinar is Babylon. So they've come southeast. It says east, so maybe they swung a little bit south and then came over east, I don't know. But they've come from up here in Turkey down to here in these first few generations following the flood. And they said, well, come, let us make bricks and burn them thoroughly. And they used brick for stone, and they used tar for mortar. That territory did not have it wasn't terribly rocky, and so they couldn't build anything out of stone. They had to make their own bricks, kind of like an adobe type thing, where they could bake something up and harden it and use their own stone. So it just wasn't a region suitable for building with stone. They had to make something. And they said, verse 4, come, let us build for ourselves a city and a tower whose top will reach into heaven. And let us make for ourselves a name, lest we be scattered abroad over the face of the whole earth. What did God tell them to do? Scatter abroad over the face of the whole earth. And they said, hey, let's build us something that will keep us here unified together, or we'll end up doing what God told us to do. Let's not do that, is the thinking of these people. This is clearly a direct rebellion against God. The general population is already rebelling against God, disobeying His commands, and trying to do something differently. They want to make this skyscraper that would be a testimony to themselves and to their own greatness. Apparently not everybody on the earth was in this group, but most of them were. So they think there's perhaps somebody else that will see what they're doing here. So let's make this thing and defy what God told us to do, and we'll make a monument to our own greatness. And the Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the sons of men had built. Kind of a anthropomorphism there, anthropomorphism, attributing human-like traits to God. He came down to see them, like He descended on a ladder to check out what they were doing. He, of course, knew what they were doing, but it's just a figure of speech. It's an expression. God's right hand, for example, something like that, same sort of thing. So God comes down and checks this out, and He sees what's going on and says in verse 6, behold, they're one people, and they all have the same language. And this is what they began to do, and now nothing which they purpose to do will be impossible for them. They can achieve about anything. All speaking the same language, working well together, following Satan's lead in rebellion and disobedience to God. There's no end to what they can accomplish, He says. So verse 7, the solution He comes up with is, come, let us go down and there confuse their language that they may not understand one another's speech. So the Lord scattered them abroad from there over the face of the whole earth, and they stopped building the city. Therefore its name was called Babel, because there the Lord confused the language of the whole earth, and from there the Lord scattered them abroad over the face of the whole earth. How many different languages do you think He created? If there's going to be 70 different nations, maybe 70 languages, I don't know. But enough that they can't work together anymore. Some guy was speaking one thing, somebody else speaking something else, and when you ask him to pass a hammer, he didn't know what you were talking about. Work got real inefficient. They weren't making any progress at all. So He just kind of stirred them all up and scattered them all over the earth. And this map that you've got in your handout, this is page 36, is an attempt to kind of label some of those early nations and where they settled. That thing's pretty busy. And again, take anything having to do with nation building with a grain of salt, but that's the essential summary of where those 70 nations kind of started. And here's a summary look at it at a higher level, a broader brush viewpoint. Let me get this stuff lined up here. And it would look something like this. That is, your Japhethites is what you see up there in red. Southern Europeans, Indo-Russian, all that sort of stuff. So I say most of you are probably a Japhethite. Your ancestry came from Europe. You're probably a Japhethite. Shem's descendants settled mostly there in the Middle East. And again, that H gets dropped in time, and there's Semites by the time we know anything about them. And then Ham's descendants there are northeastern Africa. Remember Canaan, all that area there where Israel is, all that was Canaanite. And also, they think the Japanese and some of the Chinese also. So that other very busy map, the black and white map, sort of folds into that summary right there when you color code the different nations. So kind of get a sense of where people started out and where they went from there. So following the dispersion of people via the language judgment that God put on them there, that sort of thing kind of took place. Then Noah goes back and he picks up again now the descendants of Shem again. Why is that? Because that's going to lead to somebody who is very, very significant and very important in the rest of Old Testament history. And that's this guy right here. Abraham. So Moses goes back and runs a quick tracery again of Shem's descendants to get us down to Abraham. Picking up at verse 10 now. These are the records of the generation of Shem. And he starts telling you who all these people are. There's Eber again in verse 14. There's Peleg again in verse 16. And then you run it on down to verse 29. Terah lived 70 years and he became the father of Abram, Nahor, and Haran. There's the line of descent of Abraham in those verses right there. His father was named Terah, verse 27. These are the records of the generation of Terah. Terah became the father of Abram. His name gets changed later to Abraham. Abram at first. Nahor and Haran. And Haran became the father of Lot. So Lot is in what relationship to Abraham? His nephew, isn't it? It's his brother's son. And Haran died in the presence of his father Terah in the land of his birth in Ur of the Chaldeans. So all of a sudden now, Lot doesn't have a father. So Abraham kind of picks him up, sort of adopts him in essence and says, hang with me and I'll kind of take care of you and we'll do things together. So that's where and how Lot gets sort of associated with and connected with Abraham. And where they lived when all of this started was a place called Ur. And this map is in your page 37 of your handout. Ur is over here. Ur was in Mesopotamia, what is today Iraq. If God was picking him today, he'd be an Iraqi. But back in those days, he was just a Mesopotamian. And that's where he was when we first meet him here in Scripture, is living over there in that area. Abram and Nahor took wives for themselves. The name of Abraham's wife was Sarai. That gets changed, of course, later to Sarah. So if I call her Sarah, same person, don't be confused by that. And the name of Nahor's wife was Milcah, the daughter of Haran and father of Milcah and Iscah. And Sarai was barren. She had no child. Now, in this part of the world at this time, that was not good. Barrenness was a downer. Women labored bitterly under that status in the society of their day, having no children. But she didn't have any. Who controls the fruit of the womb? God controls it. You can do everything you can to try to produce a child, and if he does not grant that conception, you're not going to have one. He controls the womb. And Sarai, she had no children as of this time. And that becomes a major, major factor in what goes forward. So Terah took Abram his son and Lot the son of Haran his grandson and Sarai his daughter-in-law and his son Abram's wife, and they went out together from Ur of the Chaldeans in order to enter to the land of Canaan, and they went as far as Haran and settled there. You see where they're going now? You could go across the desert here if you wanted to. It was a lot harder. So they try to go around it. So they go up here to Haran, up here in the north, on their way down to Canaan. Now, we haven't been told yet how Abram learned that, but we will be told that. We're going to get to that. He does know where he's supposed to be going. So they leave Ur of the Chaldeans and they head up around this way, but they stop here. They stop up here at Haran. And the days of Terah were 205 years, and Terah died in Haran. So these moved from here up to here, but they haven't come all the way around yet into what is Palestine or the land of Canaan. Now, what happens next? In chapter 12 of the book of Genesis is eschatologically monumental. From this point in the Word of God, from Genesis chapter 12, through the rest of the entirety of the Scriptures, two major themes will be developed. There's a bunch of sub-themes, but two major themes will develop from this point forward. One of those two major themes will involve a covenant that God makes with Abraham. And the other major theme starts developing mainly in Acts chapter 2, and that's the theme of the church. Two biblical themes fill up the rest of Scripture. This covenant that we'll look at next time and the details of it and what it includes and what it's all about and what God's doing through it. And the second major theme is the church, the body of Christ, what it's all about and what God is doing in the world through it. We got 70 different nations now that God could pick from if he wanted to pick somebody, and he does want to pick somebody, and he does pick somebody to provide universal salvation for all of the other 70, 69, and that's what he's going to do. And then later, when that doesn't work out all that well, he picks a second entity to provide universal salvation for the world, and that's the body of Christ, that's the church. And we won't talk about that too much in here. If you were with us when we went through Ephesians, you got a absolute heavy dose of the church and what that's all about. But the one major theme we're going to see here in our study in Genesis, and that's what we'll start next time in Genesis chapter 12, this covenant that God makes with Abraham. It is the single most significant event in the entire Old Testament. The Abrahamic covenant. Okay? So we'll get into that next time. So what have we seen this morning? Well, we've seen the flowing of mankind down from Noah's day into 70 different nations, and the breaking up of the languages into, I don't know the exact number, probably 70 of those, that scattered those people all over the earth like they were supposed to in the first place. And God is going to then begin to do a work to start to develop his plan of salvation for mankind through a relationship with one of those nations that we've just seen the ancestry thereof, the Semites, and in particular, an individual named Abraham. All right, see where we've been and where we're going? We'll review where we're going again next time when we get into the Abrahamic covenant. Very, very important event. Any questions or comments about anything we've seen here today? Yeah, Bill.
Did the archaeologists, did they come up with where they think the Tower of Babel is?
Have archaeologists discovered where the Tower of Babel is? I don't know of anybody that claims to know the area. We know in general it's there in that plain in Babylon. But I don't know of anybody that's found what they think is actually the construction of that tower. It may be, but I just don't know about it. I've never heard that talked about much. But it's there in Babylon, and it's interesting to note that that tower, that effort led by Nimrod, that guy, sort of sets a pattern for all kinds of false religion that falls down through the years. There's a guy that's written a book called The Two Babylons, a guy named Alexander Hislop. He traces the history of much of the idolatry and false religions of the world back to that very event, the Tower of Babel. So if you're interested in that sort of thing, The Two Babylons, Alexander Hislop, if you're interested. Anything else? Any other questions or comments? We'll see you next Thursday, Lord willing. Have a good week.